This episode is brought to you by BattleBards, premier tabletop audio for your campaigns. Use the coupon codes GMJ1, 2, or 3 to get free bonus tracks with your first order at BattleBards.com. Star Walker Studios presents Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. Hello, gamer! Greetings, fellow GM and or player. Welcome to episode 109 of Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. I'm your host, Lex Starwalker, and I'm transmitting to you today from the Obsidian Monolith somewhere outside time and space. Today, I'm returning to my discussion of the cleric in D&D. We've spent the previous two episodes in this series outlining the problem and posing possible solutions. Today, I'm going to go into what I think is the best solution we have access to, which is using your setting to make the cleric awesome. I'll discuss some of the ways I'm trying to do this with my own homebrew world of Primordia. So crack open a cold one, sit back, relax, and roll for initiative. Hey, hey, welcome back to Game Master's Journey. It's really great to be back for episode 109, and this is going to be a fun episode because it's tying in two different series I've been doing on the show. One is my series of world building episodes. So this is my 13th world building episode. And the other is my series on the cleric in D&D and how we can make the cleric a more attractive choice for players. And this is the third part of that series. Today, our topic is the cleric in D&D and how we can use the setting and how we run the game to address this problem. And if you're new to the show and you're not sure what I'm talking about, you want to check out episodes 103 and 104, and I'll have those linked in the show notes, A More Attractive Cleric Parts 1 and 2. I have gotten a lot of feedback on this topic, and I'm not going to go laboriously through every single piece of feedback I've gotten because that would just take forever. But I do want to hit some of the highlights, and you know, a lot of the feedback kind of has common themes, so I can take one piece of feedback and kind of cover a lot of related pieces of feedback, if you get what I'm saying there. And you know, I don't want this show to be 8 hours long, so we do what we can. Josh Hancock commented on Google Plus and said, "I've said it once, I'll say it 1,000 times. I love what Lex does." Well, thank you, Josh. "We do not see things the same way. I love clerics. I see them as being a conduit of the gods, and that inspires me to play a character, not a role. Everything I do as a cleric is driven by my service to my god slash pantheon. Will I be thought of as the healer? Probably. I would heal my companions unless, of course, they went against my religion's teaching severely enough. That's where RP opportunities arise and stories are created. The reason I haven't played clerics exclusively, despite how much I love the idea of playing one, is mechanics." So I'm going to stop right there and just say that, you know, this discussion is from the perspective of me as a dungeon master. I'm not talking about me as a player. I actually enjoy playing clerics, especially in 5th edition. Or I would say 5th edition is the first time I've enjoyed playing clerics. I've always liked the idea of them for the reasons that Josh says here, you know, being a conduit for your god and having something bigger than yourself to motivate you and just starting the game out with all this built into your character, all these hooks and whatnot that most player characters don't have unless the player really, you know, develops an extensive backstory. So I personally love playing clerics. I think they're awesome. I think they're one of the better classes in the game for role-playing. My point of view on this discussion is purely from that of the dungeon master and the fact that I don't see players playing clerics in my games. And I don't see many people playing clerics in any games that I see, whether it's at a gaming store or on YouTube or whatever. So Josh is going to talk about mechanics. He says, I was born and raised in D&D during the third edition 3.5 era. I didn't play fourth edition. I was disappointed by how unawesome the cleric was, so I went away from them. I'm much happier now with fifth edition clerics. Yeah, I agree. Clerics weren't great in third edition, although the domains were really cool. And I think that's where this idea of domains came from, was third edition. In second edition, clerics had spheres of magic, which were kind of like schools of magic, but they didn't really have domains per se. And so I think that the addition of domains was really cool, and this idea that you could get access to certain, quote, non-cleric spells because they were related to your god's portfolio. So if you worship a god of storms, then you might get access to lightning bolt or call lightning or spells like that that wouldn't normally be on your list as a cleric, but they are because those spells really fit with your deity's idiom. And I thought that was really cool. I don't think it was done very well. I tried more than once to play a cleric in third edition and Pathfinder. It's kind of the same thing. And never enjoyed it, never really had the character I wanted, never felt I was super effective or comparable to the other player characters at the table. But the idea was there. I think in fifth edition, they've finally taken the domain idea and they've made it work. All right, getting back to Josh's message. To me, the cleric isn't a heavy armor wearing holy warrior. That's the paladin. As weird as it may seem to some, the drow priestesses are some of the best representatives or representations of clerics I've come across. Yeah, I agree. As far as the literature, you know, D&D novels, I would agree the drow priestesses as portrayed by R.A. Salvatore in the Dark Elf trilogy were awesome and are the only time I can think of in any D&D novels that I thought clerics were cool. Every other instance of clerics I remember reading in any of the novels seemed kind of dumb or just boring. As for the point Lex made about setting differences, I've only seen arcane and divine magic as vastly different, and merging them doesn't sit well with me. The cleric may be the least popular of the core classes, but perhaps that's because the class appeals to a minority. The other divine characters, druid, ranger, and paladin, have more going for them. The druid can shapeshift, the paladin is a holy warrior, and the ranger is like a martial druid without shapeshifting. See, I disagree with that. I'd say that the cleric has way more going for him than the druid than the ranger or the paladin. That's just me. If we look at the cleric as a pure spellcaster, like the wizard, sorcerer, or even the warlock, then the cleric still falls short. Yes, divine magic is more subtle and less flashy than arcane magic, but it can still be cool and awe-inspiring. I'll say it again, conduit of the gods. So thank you, Josh, for that. And, you know, some of this feedback, I'm just going to give it to you because there's a lot of it, and I don't necessarily agree with all of it, but I want to share other points of view because my point of view isn't the only point of view. And these kinds of things aren't really so much a right or wrong kind of thing. It's more, you know, that's why this is a world building episode, because it's more about your setting that you're building and what kind of feeling you want your setting to have. And it's also partly what kind of a game experience you want to have and you want your players to have. You know, that's the kind of stuff that a lot of this kind of goes into. So, you know, like I disagree with Josh about, you know, arcane versus divine magic, but that's probably because I'm thinking from the perspective of Primordia and how things work in Primordia. I don't know what kind of a setting Josh runs D&D in, but it's probably not Primordia. So things are different, you know? So this isn't like we're going to find a right answer for everybody. You know, it's going to vary depending on what setting, you know, you're in, because if you're running Eberron, it's going to be very different than Dragonlance or Forgotten Realms or some homebrew setting, right? So, you know, hopefully this discussion will be helpful to you no matter what setting you're using, but, you know, everybody's got to make their own decisions about this kind of stuff. So thanks again for commenting, Josh. I also had another comment on the last Cleric episode from Andrew McLaren on Google+. Andrew says, I've come away from this episode now awake to what a pain in the ass gods are in D&D. Yes, they definitely can be. You have to have them because of clerics, but it's so hard to make them cool. Well, actually, you don't have to have gods because of clerics. You could easily still have clerics in your game and not have gods. You know, there's this idea of a cleric who doesn't worship a specific god, but just follows a morality or a code of ethics or whatever. I mean, if you're running your own world, or even if you're running Forgotten Realms or whatever, you're the dungeon master. What you say goes. You can do whatever you want. So you could easily have clerics in your game and not have gods at all. So I don't think it's true that you have to have gods just because there are clerics. I think you can do away with them if you really don't want them. If there's no cleric in the party, then everyone else in the party tends to completely ignore the gods, and time spent thinking about gods is wasted by the DM. Well, I mean, that's kind of on you as DM, though. You know, the players will spend time thinking about what you establish is important in your campaign. So if there's no player character that's a cleric in your campaign, and so because of that, you never do anything with the gods and you don't make them relevant, then yeah, the gods aren't going to matter. But again, that's on you as a DM. You're in control of what the players perceive as relevant or not based on what you've put the spotlight on during your campaign. And that's part of what I'm going to talk about later in the show when I start talking about using setting to make clerics more cool. And that's going to be one of my main points is, you know, part of that is you need to make the gods relevant no matter what. I mean, the gods are, if you have gods in your world, they're relevant, right? Otherwise, why would they be there? I mean, if you have gods in your world and you're not making them relevant, then I would suggest you either make them relevant or get rid of them because they're not serving any purpose. It's just dead weight. So if you have gods, use them, make them relevant. It doesn't matter if there's a player character that's playing a cleric or a paladin or not. It's not like, you know, in a world where the gods are real and they really exist and they're movers and shakers in the world, it's not like they're not going to mess with you just because you don't have a cleric in your midst. The gods are going to do what they're going to do, and they don't care about your party makeup. All right, so back to Andrew's message. Maybe they become important as antagonists. So he's talking about gods here. If the PCs reach epic levels, I don't know. I've never had a game get to that level. And again, I'll talk about this later, but your player characters don't have to be high level to make the gods relevant. You know, there are a million ways to make gods relevant other than just your in the gods plane talking face to face with the god. And I would argue even in an epic campaign that should probably almost never happen. Because it's not very interesting, really. And as a dungeon master, it's going to be very hard to convincingly roleplay a deity. You're much better off at best having the player characters encounter an avatar, or even better, an angel or some other minion of the god. And you can encounter a minion of the god at first level. It could be a cleric of the god. It could be a deva. It could be a coatl. It could be all kinds of things, depending on the god. All right, back to Andrew. He says, right now, I'm liking the way Dark Sun approached the gods. There aren't any. They've been killed or gone away. Now clerics bond to elemental powers. I think that makes the setting cooler rather than feeling like the setting is missing out on opportunities that gods might bring. So yeah, you know, that's definitely a way you could do it. Or another way you could do it is clerics are just following an alignment. So maybe there's some non-personified power of lawful good. So if you're a lawful good cleric, you're channeling power from that. You know, there's a lot of different ways you could do it. You know, having gods is just one way. But gods are nice because they're personalities, they're characters of their own, and they can make things happen in the world, and they can bring surprises to the game, and they can be pulling strings behind the scenes, which can be a lot of fun. Scott Ryan also commented on Google Plus on the last cleric episode, and he says, it's hard not to write a novel on this topic. Yes, it is, and that's why these episodes get so long. Great episode. The biggest failing, in my opinion, of every version of D&D is the magic system. In early editions, the wizard mage spellcaster was always a glass cannon, and if they survived to high level, they got some cool AoE damage or some kind of uber utility. Clerics have always felt to me like they fit a nice role between being a fighter and being a glass cannon, But more times than not, the utility of healing relegates them to the back of the group, being, like you mentioned in the episode, a sort of sentient mobile magic item or artifact. I think the design in 5e really helps add some mechanics to the class that have never existed before, but it's hard to shake the stereotype that as a cleric, it's your job to heal. So I agree with that, and I would say that it's the job of the DM, and it's also the job of the players at the table to shake that stereotype. And I think the first step in that is in session zero, or in your next session, if you're already up and running, is have a talk with the group and say, hey, you know, this is a stereotype and I don't want the stereotype in my game. You know, the clerics are not just heal bots in my game, and make that clear, and maybe describe some of the other ways a cleric could be played that are more interesting and more fun. So Scott actually had quite a bit more to say. He started getting into different ideas of doing different things with the mechanics of the cleric, which I'm not going to go into because, again, I'm not interested in monkeying with the mechanics of the cleric. I'm convinced that the answer here is one of setting and one of DM style and just how you run and present the game to your players. But if you want to go check out the post in the Game Master's Journey Google Plus community on episode 104, you can see more of that discussion and give your input. I also got an email from Craig Edwards on the topic, and Craig played in my Obsidian Monolith Numenera campaign, and he's playing in my Curse of Strahd campaign, and he had some really great ideas on the cleric. So Craig says, I was listening to your cleric podcast today, and I totally agree with your thoughts on why people don't play a cleric as far as the entire religion thing. I was thinking of playing a cleric in our Strahd campaign, but I didn't because, number one, I don't know the pantheon well enough, and number two, I don't like being beholden to Dungeons & Dragons visions of a god, especially when others at the table and watching at home have their own ideas of how that god should act that are better informed. A solution to this may be that when a cleric is created, they create their own god or aspect of a god that they follow. In a polytheistic universe, should there not be an unlimited amount of gods and each have an unending amount of forms? Allow the player to create their own deity and the code that goes along with this, then integrate it into the world. This solves the issue, as no one else can tell me how this major part of my character should be, and I don't need to have a bunch of knowledge about the setting to play my character the way I want. This god could be just a different aspect of an existing god, or be something totally new. Always put the work on the players if you can. And I completely agree with this. I think this is the way to go, and this is the way I'm going in Primordia. This is one of the reasons that I'm going the route of having aspects of my gods, as I've discussed in quite a few previous world building episodes. You know, I right now in Primordia, I only have 9 deities, but each of those gods has multiple aspects. And this is exactly how I do it. When I have a player want to play a cleric, I start out and I say, here are the gods of Primordia. And, you know, each god is associated with a domain. So, you know, you can kind of start from there, you know. But then each god also has numerous aspects. And if I have aspects for a given god, like, you know, I talked in a previous world building episode about Steve wanted to play a cleric of the death god of Hades. So maybe I had a few aspects of Hades already, right? And I'm like, well, here's a few aspects of Hades. If you really like one of these and one of these really fits your character, then awesome, run with it. But if not, feel free to come up with your own aspect. And this is a way that you can basically, like Craig is saying, the player can invent their own god. And then as a dungeon master, I look at this aspect of, say, the god of Hades that this character has created. And then I decide what to do with that. That could either be an aspect that already exists in my world, and I can say, okay, this aspect that this player character created is the aspect of Hades worshipped in this part of the world, or was an aspect of Hades that was worshipped, you know, in the past, maybe 300 years ago or something. So I can take it and even though it didn't really exist because we just created it, I can say that that's always existed in the world and that's an aspect that people worship. And in which case, you know, this player has just helped me with some more world building for the world. Or I could say, well, this is a new aspect. So it could be a new aspect that only this character worships. You know, maybe this cleric has her own kind of spin on the god of death and she actually worships an aspect that's unique to her. And maybe if she can get enough people kind of thinking the way she thinks and approaching Hades the way she does, maybe that aspect will become a thing that exists beyond that one character and becomes a new aspect of the god that is worshipped by many people. Or it could always just be this particular character's personal take on the god. That's fine too. But, you know, one of the issues that I have seen come up time and time again in the feedback that I've gotten that people have with the cleric is the thing of player agency and DM fiat and the fact that when you play a character, you are kind of handing over a big chunk of your cleric character to DM fiat because you may not have any control on what that god is like or what that god expects of you. And it is such a major part of your character that it's kind of like letting your DM make half your character for you. And, you know, some people aren't comfortable with that or they want to have it be more their own thing. So this, you know, method like Craig's talking about and I'm talking about of either just letting your player create a new god or a new aspect is a way that they can take some of that back. I mean, ultimately, yes, it's going to be your job as a dungeon master to play that god and decide what that god does and what how it responds to what the player character does and stuff like that. But the player gets to define that aspect of the god, you know, what it's like, what it expects of them and things like that. And so that's a way that you can mitigate that feeling of loss of control of your character that, again, is one of the main complaints I've seen in the feedback about the cleric is that perception of loss of agency or that concern of, you know, how much power over my character is the DM really going to have? All right, so Craig goes on to say, if you want a mechanical element or two, and I don't think it's needed, but you could allow clerics to create their own domains simply by combining two already existing domains. And yeah, I think that's all I'm really going to say on that. That's definitely a way you could approach it. I would be a little concerned about balance issues because, you know, if you're telling a player that they can basically combine two domains, you know, there's a lot of munchkin players out there that are going to try to make the most broken domain combination that they can. So I think as a dungeon master, if you go that route, it's going to be a headache because you're going to have to constantly police what the players are doing. And it's really going to be hard to avoid that problem without just telling them, here's the domains you can combine, here's the ones you can't. At which point, like how much, you know, how much creative freedom do they really have if you're basically saying, here's a list of do's and don'ts, you know? So, yeah, personally, I would be more prone to create a new domain than to try to combine two different ones. And I would do that as a dungeon master. I wouldn't let a player do that because, again, even it's funny, but even players who run their own games will try to pull shit in your game that they would never allow in their game. And I've seen this more times than I can count. So, you know, to let a player create a domain, I mean, you can try it, but there's going to be a lot of back and forth and you're going to, you know, have to do a lot of editing and revising of that because it's going to be rare that a player is just going to hand you a domain and you're going to look at it and be like, yeah, that looks great. It's probably going to be overpowered. It's going to be unbalanced and you're going to have to fix it. And then you kind of have to fight this player who's married to these ideas he's had because you want to change them because they're not going to work. So honestly, I think it's just a lot easier just to create the domain yourself as a DM and just say, hey, here's a domain that's associated with your god that you have access to. But that's just the way I'd approach it. Also got an email from Shane, aka Mundangerous, from the Total Party Thrill podcast. Love that show. And Shane wrote in with some good thoughts on the cleric. So this is all mechanical stuff, but you know, this is going a bit out of my depth, but I thought I would share it with you, and you can make of it what you will. So Shane says, mechanically speaking, the cleric isn't as strong or as diverse as you've suggested. Cleric domains don't provide as much variability as other archetypes. There are basically two types: caster domains that get potent spell casting, and melee domains that get divine strike. There's only nominal differentiation between them otherwise, with the exception of Arcana domain, whose level 17 ability is probably broken, though it's level 17, so who's going to notice? So I don't know. I don't know that I agree with this. This seems to be completely ignoring your spell list, which to me as a player, when I make a cleric character, that's what I'm looking at when I choose a domain. I don't so much care about what kind of extra D8 damage I get, whether it's radiant or necrotic or whatever, or if I can fly at 17th level, or like, I don't so much care about that. I mean, it's kind of cool flavor stuff. But what I'm looking at when I pick a domain is I'm looking at the spells. I'm looking at those domain spells, you know, and to me, that's where it's really at. And I think that there is a lot of variation in the cleric domains. And, you know, you have clerics casting Burning Hands and all these other spells that normally clerics don't have. And I think, you know, if you have two clerics in your party of different domains, if they're using their domain spells and they're really playing that domain and playing a cleric of that domain, then I think that the clerics are going to be very different as far as in the flavor and how they play their characters and what spells they're using throughout the session. I think they'd be at least as different as two specialist wizards of different schools would be. Let's see. Shane goes on to say, cleric non-spell abilities scale poorly. How many CR4 undead are level 17 clerics catching with Destroy Undead? Yeah, that's true. And, you know, that's definitely a possible issue, you know, unless you're throwing a lot of undead at your party, you know, they may not use that ability very much. But most of the domains, I believe, give something else to do with Channel Divinity other than Turn Undead. And the clerics I've played, I've never actually used Turn Undead. I always use the other thing. I just started playing a cleric in a game that a buddy of mine is running, and I'm playing a war cleric, and I'm trying to remember what the Channel Divinity ability is. I think you get an extra attack, or you do extra damage, or you get plus 10 to hit, or something like that. I remember all the abilities, but I don't remember what comes from what. But, you know, I use that all the time. I use my non-turn undead channel ability all the time. And that's what I think is cool about the cleric in 5th edition compared to previous editions, is you can use that for other things. You know, if this was 2nd edition, or I think even 3rd edition, where turn undead is just turn undead, then yeah, you know, it can be limited in usefulness or completely useless depending on the campaign you're in and what you're up against. Or it could be completely overpowered if everything you fight is undead. And then there are some domains that let you turn other things. For instance, the Arcana domain, or Arcane domain, whatever it's called, lets you turn things like outsiders instead of undead, which is kind of cool. Divine Intervention really isn't as strong as it looks. Once a week, you have a 10 to 19% chance to cast up to a 9th level cleric spell. At 20th level, you get to cast 8 9th level cleric spells per week. Well, yeah, I mean, if you're going to boil it down to just the mechanics in the book, yeah, that's all it is. But if that's all you're doing as a DM with Divine Intervention, that's kind of lame. I mean, if I had a player character use Divine Intervention and they just wanted to basically cast a 9th level cleric spell with it, I'd be like, you're completely missing the whole point of this ability. You know, you're not limited to cleric spells for Divine Intervention. It's Divine Intervention. It's anything within the power of your deity that your deity will do for you. You know, I mean, to me, Divine Intervention is more for the DM than the players anyway. I look at Divine Intervention, and as a DM, I get really excited. I'm like, I can't wait until I have a player character that can use this, because it's awesome, you know. And I would be giving all kinds of situational modifiers to that. You know, there would be times as a cleric in my game where you might use divine intervention and it might just work automatically, or you might have way higher than 19% chance because you're doing something that God wants you to do, or you're trying to accomplish something that God wants you to accomplish, or I just think what you're doing is really cool as a DM, so I'm going to throw you a bone. You know, and I think that's one of the problems with the cleric is I think one of the big problems with the cleric is the dungeon master and how the dungeon master is approaching the cleric. And that's kind of the whole theme of this episode today is how can you as a dungeon master make the cleric better? And you don't need to change any mechanics to do it. It's all how you approach it. Divine intervention, as described in the book, is the minimum that it can do, right? That's where the player can say, hey, look, here in the book, it says I can do this. And as a DM, you should probably not, you know, you should give them that. But that's the minimum, right? As a DM, you can always make it cooler than that, or you can increase the chance that it happens, or increase how often they can do it if it's an especially appropriate use, right? Because that's the thing, is the cleric is working for the deity, right? So let's imagine, you know, you have this cleric of the god of war, right? And the cleric's asking for divine intervention. Well, if the cleric's asking for divine intervention to help the cleric do something that the god of war wants that cleric to do, first of all, he might not even have to roll. It may just happen because the god of war wants that to happen. And second of all, it may not count against his uses of divine intervention because the god's kind of like, hey, I'm really glad you gave me a chance to step in here. You know, I've been kind of busy and wasn't really paying attention to what you're doing. And this is really important to me. So I'm really glad that you, you know, called the bat phone and was like, hey, I need some help with this because I want this to happen. So I'm going to do it and I'm not going to hold it against you. That's the way I'd handle it. All right, back to Shane's email. Healing, as we both covered, is almost always a wasted action in combat until the target is making death saving throws. Yeah, I agree with that. Cleric is a support class in the strictest sense. Her action economy is a disaster, meaning she will always be foregoing her cool thing to fix someone else's problem. I guess that's okay because her cool thing is rarely that cool. So I don't know. You'll have to decide. I don't really agree with that, but I mean, I haven't had a lot of people play clerics, so, you know, it seems like Shane has gotten into the nuts and bolts of the mechanics a lot more than I have, so I'm not really going to argue with him on the mechanical stuff because I really don't know. But to me, that's not the problem. I've played a cleric. I've played a couple clerics in 5th edition, and I never had a problem with my action economy or feeling like I didn't have anything cool to do or feeling like I had a cool thing to do, but instead I had to do something else because I was a cleric. I've never once felt that way. Just the other week, I played my cleric who is 8th level, I think. And I play a war cleric. And, you know, every turn I was using my bonus action to either make an extra attack or give someone a plus 10 bonus on their attack or give myself a plus 10 bonus on their attack. I was pretty much using my bonus action every turn. It was rare that I didn't have some use for my bonus action. And I was also using reactions a lot because I believe I have a reaction where I can give a plus 10 to someone's attack roll. So I don't know. I don't know how that compares to other people's action economy, but I didn't have any complaints. I had a blast and I was holding my own in combat with, you know, we had a fighter in the group. We had a wizard. I'm trying to think what else we had. A druid. And I was holding my own. If anything, I'm afraid I maybe outshine the fighter a bit. Of course, I was rolling pretty well too, but still, it was awesome. But, you know, cleric is in a lot of ways a support class. And you know, that could be a part of the problem with the class too is, you know, not everybody likes that role. But I would argue that you don't have to play a cleric that way. It's probably the most, quote, optimal way to play a cleric if you care about that. But you don't have to play it that way. Clerics have plenty of spells that aren't support spells, or, you know, instead of using those spells to enhance your companions, you can use them to enhance yourself. So, you know, I think the cleric is a lot of fun to play as a support class, but I don't think you have to play them that way. So Shane goes on to say, but while religious overtones or mechanical woes might be contributing factors, there's a simple explanation for the cleric's troubles, DM fiat. And here I completely agree. As underwhelming as the cleric's undead focused abilities are, man, is that a huge chunk of your sheet left up to DM fiat? Yes. If your DM doesn't care to use undead regularly, your situational abilities just became worthless. If he does, well, your easy win button ruin the other player's fun. How can 5 minutes of spotlight while you effortlessly clear a room of zombies possibly overcome the boredom of slogging through six other combats, mostly ineffectively? Well, again, this is on the DM, right? I think as a DM, I don't think you need to tailor your adventures to what the player care or what the player's role for their characters. Just because someone plays a cleric doesn't mean you need to put undead in your adventure when they didn't exist before. But, you know, if someone is playing a cleric, and if there is a cleric that all they can do with turn is turn undead or with channel divinity, I'm not sure if there is a cleric that's all they can do. But if there is, and someone rolls a cleric and all they can do with channel divinity is turn undead, and you know there's not going to be any undead in the game, you know, you might want to tell the player, hey, just so you know, there's not going to be any undead. So I just want to let you know before you roll this character that, you know, your turn undead is going to be worthless. And the player may be like, oh, well, that sucks. I'm going to play something else. Or they may not care. I had a character in my Ravenloft game who had a part of their class mechanics that was not going to come into play. Or no, I take it back. It was their background. And I told the player, I was like, hey, just so you know, you're going to be in Ravenloft, not the Forgotten Realms. So the fact that you're a member of one of the Forgotten Realms groups, it's the Ranger Druid one. I can't remember what they're called, but the fact that you're part of this group isn't going to have any bearing whatsoever in the campaign because you're in Ravenloft, and I'm not going to finagle some way for it to matter because I don't think it makes sense just because you are a member of this group. So, you know, if you want to choose a different background, go for it. And he kept the background and he's like, no, that's cool. This is part of my concept. I don't really care if it comes into the game mechanically or not. But I do think it, you know, if you have a situation like that and you have a player picking something in their character that is not going to come into play and you don't want to just add it in because they're playing that character, I would tell them before they reached a point of no return so they can maybe play something else if they want to. Shane goes on to say, also, a DM could pick on the party's lack of healing and resurrection, but then they have to find a solution, like hiring an NPC to provide support. With NPC support, it's just a brief plot complication. If they somehow can't fill the role, then you've given them a problem they could only solve by metagaming, literally picking different characters. That's a lousy game. DMs need to build their games for the party they have, so the cleric is no more required than a wizard, fighter, or rogue. See, I'll have to disagree there. I know that's a school of thought that many DMs have, but I don't subscribe to that. I don't tailor things to what the players play to that degree. At that point, it's like, why even have a chance of failure if I'm just going to tailor everything to every decision you make and make that the right decision? It's like if you as a group make a party that has no healing ability, that's not my problem as a DM. That's your problem as player characters, because you know that healing is something that needs to happen in this game. And all of you have chosen to roll characters that have no ability with that. And you've chosen to create a party that has no ability in that. So that's a problem that you need to solve. You've created this problem. You need to solve it. Don't expect me to, I don't know, create an adventure where it's okay not to have any healing ability, because I'm not going to do that. That's not how I roll. You know, there are so many ways. You could buy a crap ton of potions. You can hire an NPC healer to go with you, but you're going to have to pay them and they're going to get an equal share of XP, which means you're going to level more slowly than if one of you had healing abilities. Or you're going to have to buy a magic item that can heal or take lots of short rests or something. You know, it's something you're going to have to overcome. Just like if you don't have a rogue in the party, and you need to open a locked door, you got to figure that out. I'm not just going to give you a magic skeleton key that unlocks every door because you don't have a rogue. It's just not how I roll. So there's some mechanical thoughts from Shane. So, you know, I don't really agree with what he's saying as far as the cleric being so horrible to play. I haven't experienced that myself. I on either side of the table, I have had a couple clerics in games I've run, and I've never noticed them being any less effective than any other character. But you know, I don't dig into the mechanics that to that degree. So, you know, I'm not saying that Shane is wrong, because honestly, I don't know, because I haven't, you know, gotten into the nitty gritty of the mechanics and comparing everybody's action economy. But, you know, in my experience, the mechanics aren't the problem. The problem is how I present the game, how I approach the game as a DM, player perceptions and player baggage that they're bringing, and these ideas of, oh, I'm a cleric, I have to be a healer, and setting things that are only making the gods relevant if someone's a cleric, and making the cleric just not seem like such a great choice. And I think through the setting and what we're doing in our setting and how we're presenting the game, that we can make the cleric a very attractive choice, to the point that even if there are problems with action economy or crap like that, then nobody's going to care, because the flavor is so cool and all of the non-mechanical benefits, all the DM fiat stuff is so cool, that who cares if, I don't know, I have too many things to do with my bonus action, or I don't have something to do with my reaction every turn. It's like, who cares if my character is awesome and I'm having a good time playing it? Like, that's what matters. At least that's my opinion. Your mileage may vary. It also probably depends on your players, right? You know, if you've got a bunch of Pathfinder players, then they're probably going to care about the action economy and all that.
This is Matthew Colville, and you're listening to Game Master's Journey.
All right, real quickly, I want to give a shout out to my Tier 6 patron, Mr. Steve Strickland. Let's give it up for Steve. All right. Thanks, Steve, and thanks so much to all the patrons. You guys help keep this show going, and becoming a patron of Starwalker Studios is just one of the many ways that you can help out me and help out Starwalker Studios and help out Game Master's Journey. So if you'd like to give a little back and help keep this show blaring into your ear holes every week, head on over to the website, starwalkerstudios.com/gamemastersjourney. Go into the latest episode show notes, scroll to the bottom, and I've got a whole list of things that you can do to help out. In addition to becoming a patron, you could also check out Battle Bards. So I've got a few coupon codes over there on the website, GMJ1, GMJ2, or GMJ3, that you can use on your first order with Battle Bards and get some free bonus tracks along with all the other goodies that you get. And you can get some quality tabletop audio for your RPG experience. Things like music, sound effects, monster sounds, ambient sounds, all kinds of stuff. So if you're in a situation where you can have audio when you're running your game, being able to have some ambient sounds when your player characters are in a tavern and, you know, they hear tavern sounds, or you're in a forest and you hear forest sounds, or you're sitting around a campfire and you hear the sound of the campfire and the crickets, can really add to the immersion in your game. So check out the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com, and I've got more information about that. And you can use one of my coupon codes to check out Battle Bards and get some bonus tracks. All right, so it is finally time to talk about how you can use your setting to make clerics cool again, or maybe make clerics cool for the first time. I don't think clerics have ever been cool, but they're going to be cool now, damn it. Or at least they will be in Primordia, hopefully, because I've really been given a lot of thought into how I can make clerics cool in Primordia, and that's what spurred this whole series of episodes. Was, you know, me looking at my groups that I've run and the groups that I've played in since fifth edition came out, and realizing that the clerics definitely seem to be underrepresented, thinking about why that might be and how I can solve the problem. And the conclusion that I came to personally was, I don't think the problems are mechanics. I don't think the problems are in the game itself, or in the spells, or anything like that. I think the problem is in the setting and how we as dungeon masters present the gods, how we use the gods in our stories and our campaigns, and how we approach clerics, and how we communicate all of that or don't communicate it to our players. So this is kind of what I've come up with and what I've been thinking as far as Primordia and how I'm hoping to address this. And this is not everything. This is not the end all be all. This is a work in progress here. There's still more to do. There's fleshing out that needs to be done. There's details that need to be filled in. And there's probably more I can do. So I would love to hear from you. Any thoughts you have or any additional ideas you have on how I could make clerics relevant in 5th edition and in Primordia specifically. So the first thought here is to have the gods be active in the world. And the gods need to be relevant, period. The gods need to be relevant. They need to be relevant to your players in a real, visible way that influences the game, influences how things turn out in your adventures. And that needs to be true regardless whether or not you have a cleric PC or a paladin PC or whatever. You know, we don't want this thing where, well, if someone plays a cleric, now the gods are relevant, but if no one plays a cleric, they're not. Because that's not an incentive to play a cleric. But if the gods are going to be relevant and the gods are going to be something you have to cope with as a character and as a group, then that might be an incentive to play a cleric. Cleric characters should get aid and guidance from their deities, at least indirectly. At low levels, probably not directly. But they should be getting something. And, you know, I'm not a fan of, you know, you like having coffee with your god, you know, I mean, that really cheapens the gods. And the thing is at least in Primordia, and I think anywhere, I think the gods should be beyond mortal understanding. And as soon as you're having a conversation with a character played by your dungeon master, it no longer seems beyond mortal understanding, or at the very least, it's very hard to pull that off. So, you know, my first advice would be keep the gods themselves off the stage. You know, even at epic level, I don't think you should, as a regular course, be having your player characters interact with deities directly. Instead, they should be interacting with their minions. And this is stuff you can do at first level. You can have them interact with servants of the god, like angels or other outsiders or coadals or dragons. I mean, depending on the god, depending on your world and your setting, you know, there could be all kinds of magical, powerful beings that are somewhere in between the player characters and a deity. Other methods are things like dreams and visions and omens and things like that. And those are especially nice because there's room for interpretation and you can be vague and it can be a puzzle for the player characters to figure out if the cleric has some kind of weird dream that seems to have a message in it from that character's god, but it's not exactly clear what the message is and it's kind of a riddle to solve. So you want to make the gods relevant to all the player characters, not just ones that are divine casters. If all the PCs have to deal with the gods in some way, then playing a cleric or a paladin doesn't have the drawback of, oh, now the gods are going to be involved in our business, right? It's like, no, the gods are going to be in your business no matter what, you know? And I feel like this is how it is with a lot of D&D groups. And it's this idea of if no one plays a cleric or a paladin, then the gods just won't be involved in the story. And we won't have to deal with them. But if someone plays a cleric or paladin, then we probably will. And so that can be seen as a drawback by the entire group. Not only do I, as a player, not want to play a cleric, but I kind of don't want anybody else to play a cleric either, because as soon as someone plays a cleric, now we got to deal with the gods. So the easiest way to fix that is to say, no, you have to deal with the gods regardless. Nobody plays a cleric, then you still have to deal with the gods. And then the cleric can be an asset, because it's like, well, you guys are going to have to deal with the gods regardless, but if you do have a cleric in the group, then the chances of things coming out favorably for you when you have to deal with the gods are much better because you have someone who's got the god's ear, right? Who's got some influence or at least some respect from the gods. So I think that's a great way to kind of spin it around and turn a disadvantage into an advantage. I think clerics and to a lesser degree paladins should get preferential treatment, not only from their own particular deity, but even possibly from other deities, depending on, you know, how your world works and how the pantheons work. For instance, in Primordia, a cleric will tend to get better treatment from any deity because the deities prefer people who honor the gods. And if I'm a deity, it doesn't matter which one I am, and you are a cleric of a different deity, I'm still going to think better of you than the average person because it's like, well, you may not honor me specifically, but you do honor a god and you do honor the gods. Because in Primordia, I mean, it's true polytheism. It's not this monotheism disguised as polytheism that you normally have in D&D. So you don't normally have people only worshiping one god anyway. Even the clerics will give offerings to other gods. So the gods should favor those who honor them the most and those that they've chosen. And that's another idea is, you know, if you're a cleric, you've been chosen. You don't decide to be a cleric. You know, you're chosen to be a cleric. So all the PCs have to interact with the gods. And again, not directly, but indirectly through their churches and their clergy and their followers and their minions. But clerics get better treatment from the gods and those that serve them. They get rewards and they get attention from the gods that other characters don't get. The gods are more likely to come to their aid. And this is above and beyond the divine intervention mechanic of the cleric. You know, just because you don't have the divine intervention mechanic yet as a cleric doesn't mean that a god can't come to your aid. You know, the DM can do whatever the hell he wants. And again, you know, I see the mechanics as the minimum. That's like the minimum that you owe your players. It's like, this is, you know, you get this for sure, but you may get more. That's within my judgment of whether and what you get. The gods are more likely to answer the prayers of a cleric, reward their deeds and things like that than they are with other characters. And again, you know, the PCs don't have to have face-to-face meetings with the gods to bring the gods into play. The gods have many agents in the world, angels and other outsiders, as well as their mortal followers. You know, give your cleric PCs and to a lesser degree paladins. Can we just assume that from now on? When I'm talking about clerics, it probably applies to paladins, but to a much lesser degree. So give your cleric PCs frequent dreams and visions from their god. Make these symbolic so the player has to interpret them. Don't make their meaning obvious and don't interpret them for the player and don't tell them whether or not their interpretation is correct because in reality, they wouldn't know, right? You know, they don't know if their interpretation of the vision their god sent them is right or not. They have no idea. They just have to have faith or trust in their perceptions or whatever. Some of these dreams can just be flavor to remind the players that the cleric has a source of information that's otherwise beyond them. So you can occasionally give them a dream that seems prophetic and seems symbolic, but maybe it doesn't really mean anything. Or maybe you're not sure what it means and you kind of wait and let something develop. But I wouldn't do that too much, you know. But if you're in a situation where it's been a long time and you haven't given the cleric a vision or a dream or something and you don't really have anything to give them a leg up on, you know, maybe just give them something random. Just give them some dream filled with imagery that's within their religious symbolism of their god or whatnot. I also like the idea of each god having different omens associated with it. So maybe if you worship Primordia, the goddess of agriculture, you know, maybe a sunny, cloudless day is seen as a good omen, or maybe a spring rain is seen as a good omen, or maybe a certain kind of bird flying from the east to the west is seen as a good omen, stuff like that. And so you can have something like that happen where it's like, oh, I saw a sparrow fly from east to west, which, you know, among followers of Primordia is seen as a good omen that Primordia is looking on you with favor. But that doesn't have to mean anything, right? As a DM, you can just throw that in like, hey, you see this sparrow and you know it's a good omen. but it doesn't mean something specific, right? It's just a way to bring the gods in and make them relevant. And don't make the omens always for the patron deity. You know, a cleric is going to probably know the omens, at least the more common omens of all the deities, unless you're in the Forgotten Realms and it's just a stupid amount of deities. But if you're in a more sane setting, like Primordia, where there's only 9 deities, then I would say any cleric in the world of Primordia knows some basic omens of all the deities, because again, all of the deities are relevant to every character. It doesn't matter if you're a cleric, and if you're a cleric, it doesn't matter what your deity is. They're all relevant to you, or they should be. So sometimes these omens, these dreams are just cool flavor, just to remind everyone that, hey, the gods are here, and you know, there's mysteries, and we don't know always what these omens mean or what these dreams mean, but we do know that the gods are interested in us and expect things from us, even though we're not sure what. But then sometimes have the dreams be relevant and even prophetic. They can give clues to the adventure that they're on, or, you know, a future adventure of how to get past a tough spot or how to solve a problem. These dreams or visions can be a great way to get information into the player character's hands that would be really hard to do otherwise. They're also a great way to give a hint if the party needs a hint. Keep the dream kind of vague and symbolic. You know, make the players work to figure out what exactly it means, and don't interpret it for them. Make them do the work. Sometimes the consequences of an incorrectly interpreted dream can be just as interesting or even more interesting than whatever you had planned or whatever would have happened if they'd interpreted the vision correctly. Think about that incorrect interpretation. What are the ramifications of missing the message that this dream conveyed, right? The deity or one of its servants has sent a message to the PCs and the PCs didn't get it. Or maybe they even took the opposite meaning and they've gone off in a wrong direction. What are the consequences of that? And, you know, yes, there are cleric spells like augury and things like that that a cleric can use mechanically to get some divine guidance or whatnot. But I think as a DM with divine characters in the party, and even not with divine characters in the party, you should be using these sometimes just when you want to, or when you need to, or just for flavor. You know, have a character have a dream or see a vision or see an omen. You know, maybe you don't even have clerics in the party, but maybe one character in a party is really a fan of Primordia. And so that character is off by herself bathing and she sees a unicorn. You know, it doesn't really mean anything except the character might interpret that as a good omen from Primordia or a sign from Primordia saying, keep doing what you're doing kind of thing. Could be a great role-playing opportunity if the player character is going to interact with this unicorn. I mean, there's just so many ways you can go. And I really feel like in so many campaigns, and I know in many of the campaigns I've run, the gods are really a missed opportunity. You know, and I think part of the problem is we all have our own kind of ideas and perspectives and baggage even when it comes to religion and gods and whatnot. But remember, you're the dungeon master. You're running in your world. It is your world. Even if it's the Forgotten Realms, it's your Forgotten Realms. You can do whatever the fuck you want. So do what you want. If you don't like the gods in the Forgotten Realms, use different gods. Or if you don't like the way they're portrayed, portray them in a different way. Find a way to use them, because it's a big part of the game. It's a big part of the mythology of D&D. And it's a big part of some of the characters, you know, some of the classes in the game. And so to not use that, even if you don't have any divine characters, I think it's a missed opportunity. There's so much potential for drama and mystery and those aha, eureka moments if you use the gods. So use them. So the way that I'm trying to address this in Primordia specifically is I am trying to make the gods and religion relevant to the world and relevant to the PCs, just period. It's just relevant. It doesn't matter if there's a cleric or not in the party. And so I've given a lot of thought to how to do that. Okay, so I came up with this idea of using some mechanics actually that we have in the Dungeon Master's Guide, which are the blessings and charms and whatnot in the Dungeon Master's Guide, page 228, and kind of using that as a springboard. Okay, so the idea here is that Primordia is a polytheistic world, so most people honor, if not all the gods, quite a few of them, right? And I've talked about this in the past with examples like the farmer who honors Primordia because she's involved with agriculture and gives offerings to Kordos because he's the god of the storms and whatnot, and you don't want storms destroying your crops, so you got to appease Kordos and all of the different gods that like a farmer would honor. And so part of this is I want to come up with actual religions for these deities and some of the things that people would do day to day to honor them and have this as a strong flavor within the world. So what might someone who is giving an offering to Primordia, what might that look like? Well, maybe if they're a farmer or a herdsman, maybe they sacrifice a lamb to Primordia. Or, if they're a farmer, maybe they burn, an amount of corn or whatever their crop is as an offering to Primordia. And there's a lot of culture in this because religion is really culture. So you can not only kind of build up a religion, but you can also build up the culture of that area at the same time. And the idea here is that these offerings are going on all the time. Most people are giving offerings and prayers to the gods almost every day and different gods. And for most people, it's like a thing you do. It's like in the real world, right? You go give an offering to a god or you make a sacrifice or whatever, and your day goes on. It's not like the heavens open up and light shines down on you, or, it's like nothing happens. It's just you do your thing and you go on. And that's how it is for most people. But if you're a player character, if you're an adventurer, then you are in the elite. You're unique. You're not just a cog in the wheel. You're one of the people that thinks for themselves, thinks beyond their own society and their own, how they were raised, goes out and sees the world, learns about magic and all this stuff. So just as a player character, when you make an offering to a god or you observe a rite or something for a god, there's a higher chance of getting some kind of response. And that could be one of these blessings or charms from the DMG or something like it. So, let's start with offerings. So offerings is just a way of venerating a deity. It's a way to show respect to that deity. And these can and do take many forms depending on the god that they're offered to. So each god favors different kinds of offerings. So one common type of an offering would be a sacrifice. And, this can be a blood sacrifice, where you're offering up a lamb or a person or whatever. Or it can just be a sacrifice in the sense of giving up something that's important to you. That could be money, it could be food, it could be time, or anything. It could even be your own life. And sacrificing your life could be actually, giving your life and you're going to be killed on an altar, or it could be becoming a cleric and devoting your life to serving your deity. Now, usually the value of the sacrifice or the offering is going to be based on how important the thing is to that person. So a handful of gold would be a very powerful sacrifice if made by a peasant, but that same amount of gold would be an insignificant sacrifice if it was made by a powerful noble or merchant or adventurer. Because again, the god doesn't so much care about gold. 100 gold doesn't really mean anything to God. God doesn't care. What the god cares about is the sacrifice. How much are you giving up? How much is this thing you're offering up worth to you personally? So obviously a few pieces of gold is worth a lot to a peasant, but isn't really worth anything to a noble. Also, the way I'm going to handle it in Primordia is that the gods or the aspects aren't always constant in their reward or regard for a given sacrifice. So one peasant might sacrifice 10 gold and, you know, receives favor of the god and the god really digs it. And another peasant might make the same sacrifice and God doesn't care or the god's offended, you know, and there may or may not be a reason for this that I'm aware of as a dungeon master. The whole point here is that the gods are mysterious. So you want to make them mysterious. And if everything they do makes sense or can be rationalized by the players, they're not mysterious. So every once in a while, you got to have them do something that just doesn't make sense. And you don't need to know what the reason is as a DM, you know, you don't need to. And of course, offerings are not always rewarded. Although, you know, they're usually done by people in the hopes of receiving a reward. But for most people, offerings are never rewarded. You know, your average person gives offerings to various gods their whole life and probably never once sees a tangible reward that they can say, oh, this happened because I gave this offering. People will ascribe things that would have happened anyway to the fact that they gave an offering. And I'm sure the gods are fine with that because they don't have to do anything. So usually, though, when a person does an offering, they're doing it in the hopes of a reward, and they could be hoping for something specific, like a bountiful harvest, or they could just be hoping for something general, like general favor from the god, like good luck from Imora, the goddess of luck. But like I said, most offerings aren't going to receive a reward or any acknowledgement from the god at all, because again, the gods are mysterious. And also the gods just don't care, honestly. You know, most people giving offerings are beneath the notice of the gods. You know, they're never going to amount to anything. They're never going to have any impact on anything that God cares about. So why would they care about their offering? With some deities, offerings are made not in the hopes of a reward, but in the hopes of avoiding the god's wrath. So offerings to Hades, the god of death, are often made in this way. So, you know, most people give offerings to Hades at the very least at certain points in their life. And they're not giving that offering in the hopes of getting some kind of boon from Hades. It's more of kind of paying Hades off to leave him alone and not come after him. Usually a god's going to require some kind of show of commitment from a worshiper in the form of numerous offerings made consistently over a long period of time before the god's going to bestow any kind of real favor on that person. Clerics, paladins, and other true devotees of a god, including devoted adventurers who aren't clerics or paladins, are the most likely to receive a god's favor through offerings. So, you know, if you have an NPC that's just a normal person, but that NPC is really devout to one or more gods throughout their life, then that NPC might see some form of favor from one or more of those gods at some point in their life. But that's much more likely to happen if it's a player character, and even more likely to happen if that player character is a paladin, and even more likely to happen if that player character is a cleric. When an offering is rewarded, it can result in the equivalent of a charm. And again, you can look on page 228 of the Dungeon Master's Guide for some example charms. But charms typically mimic the effect of a potion or a spell and has limited uses. Like you can only use it so many times. Usually it's just once. So you might get a charm where you can cast the spell Bless once. And once you use it, it's gone forever. Or maybe you can use it three times and then it's gone forever. That kind of thing. And there, like I said, there's a list in the DMG on page 228. But you could take any spell or any potion and make it a charm. So that's a really easy way that you can make a god relevant to even a group that doesn't have any clerics or paladins. You know, maybe they go pray at the temple of this god and they give a significant offering. Maybe they give some magic items and not like the crap that they don't want that they're never going to use. It's got to be a sacrifice is something of value to you, right? So if I'm an adventurer and I use a longbow and I never fight in melee and I find a magical longsword and I give it to the temple, like the god isn't going to care because I don't care about that longsword. I wasn't going to use it anyway. Now, if I find a magical bow and I give that to the temple, then that's a sacrifice because that's something I could have used. So those are offerings. So, you know, what I'm doing in Primordia is, you know, usually, especially with NPCs, offerings, just nothing happens. But if a PC makes a sincere offering and if it's something
substantial, you know, they're actually making a sacrifice. And especially if that PC is a paladin or a cleric, then awarding them one of these charms is a great way to give them the nod from the deity that says, yes, I accept your offering and I acknowledge that this offering is favorable to me, and therefore have this little boon in the form of a charm, which is, you know, effectively a spell or a potion that you can use once or twice or three times. So another possible benefit you could get from the gods is blessings. And again, these are on page 227 to 228 of the DMG, has some examples for you. And this is, you know, a step up from a charm or getting something for an offering. And a blessing is only received when someone does something truly momentous for a god. So, you know, this could be undertaking a quest for the god or for the church, establishing a new temple for the god, stopping that god's enemies from doing something world affecting, something like that. So something big, usually something kind of long term, like the course of an adventure or a campaign. So if you're doing something like that, a god may give you a blessing, which is basically giving you some power to help you do this thing that the god wants you to do. A cleric or a paladin or some other true devotee, probably PC of a deity, could potentially receive a blessing in advance to aid them, you know. So that you might get a blessing because you did something awesome, or you might get a blessing to help you do something awesome that you're about to do. So you as a DM should keep in mind that the gods don't give these out lightly. So, you know, these should be used very sparingly. And, you know, it should be obvious to everyone, like, what this blessing is for, why they're receiving it, and what it's for. It's given for a specific reason, for a specific purpose. And also, these blessings can be revoked at any time, at the god's whim. So the god can take it away. Also, you know, you should let your player characters know, whether you just tell them or whether you illustrate it through things that happen through the story, that people who receive these blessings are being watched. So you're kind of on the god's radar when you have one of these blessings, because the god wants to be sure that you're using it appropriately and that you're worthy of this blessing. So in this way, a blessing could be a double-edged sword if you spin it that way as a DM, as the person who receives the blessing is going to be judged on how she uses it and just her actions in general while she has the blessing. And one thing cool about blessings is they function in anti-magic fields, areas of wild or dead magic, they work normally. So, you know, these can be really cool if maybe the quest that the player characters are on will involve them fighting a powerful foe in a dead magic zone or something like that. And maybe the PCs don't even know this yet, but the god does. He knows that this is coming, and so they have this blessing to help him out. So again, blessings are in the DMG, and typically they mimic the properties of a wondrous item. So there are some examples given on pages 227 to 228 of the DMG, but you can come up with countless blessings just looking at wondrous items and, you know, picking and choosing powers that wondrous items give and using those for blessings. And then finally, another reward that I have that player characters can receive from the gods is what I call relics. And relics are basically magic items that scale in power level with the level of the player character. And this is a way for me to try to avoid something I don't like about D&D and bring in something that I do like. And it's the whole concept of a sword with a name, right? Like, you think of King Arthur, you think of Excalibur, okay? And we see this in Game of Thrones. You know, every good sword has a name, right? You've got Needle and Oathkeeper in Game of Thrones. And these aren't even, I don't think, magical weapons, although I guess they're Valyrian steel, so I guess that's kind of like a magic weapon in that setting. But they have names. And that's really cool. And that's something that we see in literature and mythology and whatnot. And it's really cool. And that's something really cool to replicate in your game. It's like, not only is this famous warrior known, but his sword is known and the name of his sword is known. Or your player character finds a sword in a ruin, a magical sword, and you start wearing it and you find out that this sword was wielded by a heroine long ago who's quite famous and people see that sword and they know what it is. They know its name. And now they expect things from you because you better live up to that sword and its history. And that's really cool flavor to bring into your world. Well, the problem with that is in the way D&D works as a game, which is, oh, well, when you're first level, you find a plus one sword. That's pretty cool. But when you're 15th level, that plus one sword isn't that great anymore. So now you're looking for a Holy Avenger or something like that. And it's not as bad now as it was in like third edition, where it's like every few levels you're swapping out magic items for a better version. It's like, oh, well, first I had a plus one sword, and I had a plus one flaming sword, and then I had a plus one flaming sword of speed, and then I had a defender, you know. And it's like every few levels you have a different sword, so you don't have that thing of having a specific weapon associated with your character. Another problem is you might have a player character who wants to have like the ancestral weapon. You know, they want to have the sword that's been handed down through their family for generations. Well, unless you're going to give that character a Vorpal sword at level one, you're going to have a problem when, you know, their plain Jane ancestral sword just isn't cutting it at level 10 and they find a magic sword and they're like, well, I want to use the magic sword because it's better. But, you know, this ancestral sword is part of my character. And in character, I don't think that I would give it up just because another sword was magical, right? So my idea of relics sidesteps all of this by allowing you to give a character an item that is appropriate for whatever level they're at. So let's say they're a first level character or second level character. You give them an uncommon magic item. So maybe it's a plus one longsword. But then as they gain level, the item gains power appropriately. So, you know, I basically just use the chart in the DMG of, you know, that tells you, oh, once you're at fifth level, I think you can start receiving rare items. And then once you're like 11th level, you start receiving very rare items, that kind of thing. And I just use that as a guide. So, you know, at first level, the item's equivalent to an uncommon item. At fifth level, it's equivalent to a rare item. You know, once you're 17th level, it's equivalent to a legendary, that kind of thing. And just have the item increase in power. And it's nice because you can have that player character start out with the ancestral weapon, and maybe it's not even magical. If you don't want them to have a plus one sword at first level, you can say you have to unlock its magical properties. You know, this part I'm talking about right now, the offerings and the blessings and the relics are actually part of a write-up I did for the patrons. So I talk about how patrons get access to game material. So this is one of the things that I put up for the patrons is I go into all this in more detail, and I give an example of a couple relics actually that I've created. And one of them is actually a magic item that I took from the DMG and just redid it as a relic. So, you know, it was actually a Holy Avenger. So I took a Holy Avenger and basically reverse engineered it into a relic so that you can give the Holy Avenger out to a first level character and have it grow with them. So by the time they're 17th level, it has all the abilities of the Holy Avenger in the DMG, but it doesn't have all that at first level. And then I also recreated a magic item from my second edition days that I created, the Sword of Elven Heroes, which is a unique item, but it's the same kind of thing. It scales with the player character. And actually, the Sword of the Elven Heroes is kind of cool that I wrote that up for the patrons, because that was the first of these I made. So that was a magic item I made for a player when I was in high school running D&D 2nd Edition. And it's only later that I realized how cool it was that I'd made this item that scaled with the player character and figured out a way to do that with other items. And so now in Primordia, it's a whole class of magic item called relics. And relics, in Primordia at least, tend to be crafted either by or at the behest of a deity. So a deity either makes it himself or has one of her angels or whatever craft a relic. Although I am kicking around the idea of having some relics that were created using elven high magic like long ago. And all the relics in my world are super old, like thousands of years old. And sometimes, you know, the powers that they get depend on the user too. So the Sword of Elven Heroes 1,000 years ago wielded by some hero might have had different abilities than it has today wielded by a different hero. So it's also a way that you can kind of customize the item to fit the player character. And you don't have to, at third level, when you give them the item, try to guess what this character is going to be like at 17th level and what kind of item they're going to need. You can figure that out later. You know, you don't have to come up with it all ahead of time, or you can, but you can change it as you go. You know, maybe you think, well, at some point the sword is going to become a defender. Okay. But then by the time you get to that point in the campaign where you're like, okay, the player character is this level, I'm going to make it a defender. Well, maybe that doesn't really fit the character concept. So you decide to have it do something else instead. So, you know, these relics are another way to bring the gods into the game, because even if you don't have a cleric in the party, you could have one of the player characters have one of these relics, or maybe they all have one. And each of these relics are very closely tied to a deity. And so the deity is going to be interested in what the wielder of this relic is doing, and they have to prove themselves worthy of it, or the deity is going to send an angel or something to take it away from them. So those are just a few ideas, a few kind of specific things that I've come up with on how to make the gods relevant to everybody. So, you know, the idea is that everybody in the world is making offerings to the gods all the time, to multiple gods. And for most people, they just do it. It's something that you do, you know, it's like going to church. Like, so many people go to church because it's just what you do, or it's what their parents did, or what, or they think it's a good idea, but they can't really tell you why. I've heard so many people say that. You know, they don't go really expecting anything to happen. It's not like you go to church and then you win the lottery, right? For most people, it's just something you do and nothing ever comes of it. Nothing comes from it. Or maybe you think that something does, or you interpret something that would have happened anyway as, oh, that happened because I prayed about this or whatever. But for most people, that's the way it is. But your player characters aren't most people. They're special. And especially in Primordia, you know, the idea, one of the founding principles behind Primordia is this idea of when you touch magic, it touches you back. And I know that sounds kind of dirty, but all I mean by that is that you cannot wield magic without it changing you in some deep fundamental way. And, you know, it's kind of like in the Witcher games, how the Witchers are kind of at the same time feared and respected by normal people. And it's that same kind of thing in Primordia with adventurers, because it's like these people use magic. And, you know, most people in the world don't use magic. I mean, they probably see magic used at some point in their lives, but they don't themselves interact with it or use it. And there's this belief, and it's a true belief, that when you use magic, it changes you. And even so far as some people believe that once you've used magic, you're not even really human anymore. And so, you know, that's part of the philosophy behind Primordia. So I'm always looking for ways to bring a focus into that. And even if I can do it mechanically. So the fact that as a player character, you're doing these same offerings that everybody else is doing, but you're more likely to get a response, even if you're not a cleric, even if you're not a paladin, even if you don't consider this deity to be your quote patron deity, right? Just the fact that you are special, that you're one of the elite, that you're one of the movers and shakers in the world, you tend to attract the attention of, if not the god itself, one of its servants when you make an offering or something like that, or a sacrifice. So you're more likely to be rewarded in some way. And so this is a way for the dungeon master to bring the gods into the campaign, even when there isn't a cleric, because the player characters could be in a bind and they don't know what to do, and they need some kind of a lead, or they need some kind of help. And one of the player characters is like, you know what? I really like Primordia, and I really feel a strong connection with Primordia. I'm going to go pray to Primordia. I'm going to make an offering. And you as a dungeon master can give them a vision, or give them a charm, or even a blessing if they're doing something important that Primordia cares about, that can help them get past that obstacle or give them that lead that they need to figure out what's going on. And again, you don't just hand it to them, you know, give them some kind of symbolic vision that they have to figure out and puzzle out. But it's a way to make the gods relevant no matter what. And then if there actually is a cleric, then those it's all magnified, right? So if that character that goes and prays the Primordia for help is actually a cleric, then chances are pretty good they're going to get some kind of response. It may be more or less helpful depending on how much of a bone you want to throw them as a DM, but they're probably going to get some kind of response. And if they're a cleric of that specific deity, like if it's a cleric of Primordia playing the Primordia, then they're probably going to get some kind of response. And, you know, again, going back to the divine intervention, don't let the mechanics limit you. Just because divine intervention is an 11 to 19% chance of working doesn't mean that you can only have divine intervention happen 11 to 19% of the time that the player characters actually ask for it or use that specific ability, right? That's just the minimum that you should give them. You know, so when a player character asks for divine intervention, it's like, well, at the minimum, you get this percentile roll. And that's basically, if I think it's not a great idea, roll the percentile. But if as a DM, I think that A, it's really appropriate for you to ask for intervention right now. B, you're in your God's favor and you've been doing the offerings and the things and you know, you're on the good list for your God. And C, you're doing something that your God cares about and you're working towards your God's end, then you may not even have to make the roll. You may just get the intervention because you're doing your God's work. And obviously your God's going to help you out, or one of its minions will. So that's, you know, that's what I'm thinking. And, you know, I'm really looking for ways to make the gods relevant to everybody, to every group, to every player character, but then give the cleric or, you know, the paladin, give them a leg up, give them extra. And this is above and beyond what the player's handbook says or what the DMG says. This is flavor stuff. This is DM fiat, right? And, you know, we've come around full circle to this whole DM fiat thing. And this problem that a lot of people have with playing a cleric is, you know, like Shane, I think, said, you know, that's a huge chunk of your character sheet that's left in the realm of DM fiat, right? So it behooves you as a DM to establish for your group and for your players what that's going to look like. And you can do that even in a campaign where there's no cleric characters by having that religion be relevant and having the gods be relevant no matter what. And so the players are seeing the gods working in the world and they're seeing the kinds of benefits that people that honor the gods are getting. And then you tell them, oh, and if you're a cleric or a paladin, it's even more so because you've kind of got your god's ear. And then you're kind of showing them that, you know, this isn't so much, you know, you playing a cleric isn't just giving me the DM free rein to screw with your character and make you do things that you don't want to do. What it's really doing is it's giving you a whole new pool of resources that you can tap into as a group for information, for aid, whether that's in the form of a spell to help you out, like a blessing or a charm, or a NPC that's going to help you, whether that's raising one of you from the dead or going with you to help you on an adventure or giving you information, that kind of thing. So, you know, I think that if we can just set player expectations as a DM, both through the way that we portray our world and the way that we handle the gods, and just, you know, through experience in our world, the players see, oh, this is how the gods work. But also in session zero, or right now, if you're already up and running, just having a discussion with your players and saying, you know, this is what I'm thinking. And if you play a cleric, this is how it's going to work, you know, and, you know, also doing like what Craig and I were talking about, we're giving your player the ability to define their own god, or at least their own aspect of a god, so they can tailor it to their character so that they can have a little more agency in what exactly this god is before they hand the deity over to you as dungeon master. And now they're in the realm of DM fiat. And, you know, I've noticed myself as a player, a lot of my decision of whether or not I'm going to play a cleric in a given game has to do with how the gods are portrayed in that setting and how the DM uses the gods and how much I trust or don't trust the DM with that kind of fiat of my character. And also what my impression is through past experiences and what I know of that DM of how she's going to handle that. You know, is she constantly going to be using that to screw me over and force me to do things? Or is it going to be more of a way for me to get information that we couldn't normally get, or to get some kind of help that we couldn't normally get? You know, and so if I'm playing with a DM that I trust and I have experience with, and I know, you know, she's not going to just be dicking me over all the time, and I'm playing in a setting where the gods are cool and where they're relevant and where I find a god I can really get behind, whether that's because there's one I really like or I can create my own, then I'm much more likely to play a cleric. But if I'm with a DM I don't know, or I don't trust, or I'm not sure how they're going to handle it, or I'm not comfortable with them having that level of fiat over my character, or I don't like the way that setting handles the gods, or I don't like any of the gods and I can't create my own, then I'm not going to play a cleric. So that's my perspective. That's what I'm thinking. And, you know, like I said, I feel like this is the tip of the iceberg of how to handle this in Primordia. So for me, the next step is going through all my deities and going through aspects and coming up with actual religions. And okay, this aspect of Primordia, these are common offerings that are made. These are common sacrifices that are made. These are common taboos that are observed and practices that are observed and things like that. And again, you know, that's something that, you know, I just follow my mantra of build what I need as I need it. So I'm not necessarily going to sit down and do that with every aspect of every deity like right now. Although I would like to have at least one or two aspects of each deity just so that I can convey the flavor of the setting and show the players kind of what's going on with these different religions in the world. But beyond that, it's kind of, you know, what do I need for the players, characters that I have, and what do I need for the story that I'm telling? And, you know, that way, if I have a player who wants to play a cleric, then they can have the freedom to invent their own aspect. And then I decide, is that an aspect that actually exists in the world or not? And if it does exist, is it just something from another area that people don't know about? Or is it maybe from the past, or it's something new? You know, come up with that kind of stuff. And then if it's not already defined, then obviously if they want to, the player can give me ideas on, you know, what are the taboos observed by people that follow this aspect? What are rituals that they observe? What are offerings that they make and things like that? So that's a great way for the player to flesh out their character more. And it's a great way to flesh out the world more. So it's a win-win, I think, for everybody. Well, I would love to hear what you think about my world of Primordia and how I'm trying to make clerics more relevant and how I'm trying to make the gods more relevant, whether or not anyone's actually playing a cleric. So you can find my website at starwalkerstudios.com/gamemastersjourney. You can find the show notes and all the episodes there, all kinds of good stuff. If you do want to send me some feedback, a great way to do so is by email. You can email me gamemastersjourney@gmail.com. You can also find me on Twitter at Lex Starwalker. You can find me on Google Plus Lex Starwalker. Another great place for feedback is our Google Plus community for Game Master's Journey. You can find links to that in the show notes. And I'm also on YouTube, Facebook, Pinterest, Reddit, all over the place. And I have a subreddit for Primordia. You can find links to that in the show notes as well, which is another great place if you want to submit thoughts or ideas, not just to me, but to everyone, so we can all see your brilliant ideas. Well, that's going to wrap up episode 109 of Game Master's Journey. Wow, this one went really long. I had a feeling it would with the feedback and everything else. So I might have to go back and split this up. We'll see how long it is after I've edited it. But I'm not sure. This might be the end of the cleric discussion. I don't know. A lot of it's going to depend on feedback I get from you and whether I feel that there's more to be said or not. I may actually revisit this in the future in a future world building episode when I have developed more of this stuff and kind of share some of the stuff I come up with. It might be cool to give you a sample of one of the aspects of one of the gods and some of the taboos and rituals and whatnot that I come up with for that particular religion and how that you know, ties into these offerings and blessings and charms and all that good stuff. That might be fun to do. So this definitely is not the last world building episode. Might be the last cleric specific episode. We'll just see what happens. I never know, you know, I've been getting a lot of feedback on this cleric topic. So it's very possible that the feedback will lead to yet another episode. So I don't know. Let me know in your feedback. Are you sick about hearing about the cleric, or do you think there's more still to be said? So I hope you have a chance to play your favorite RPG this week. I'll be back soon with another episode of Game Master's Journey. Until then, game on.
This has been a Starwalker Studios production, your source for quality gaming and hobby podcasts.
This episode's music provided by Cloudwalker, Renfield, Stanko, Transboy, and Ish. Please see the show notes for more details at starwalkerstudios.com/gamemastersjourney.